Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today we have an Iraq War vet, an anti-war and pro-justice activist, and one of the founders of Move Forward. He's also active with the Answer Coalition, Michael Preisner. Stay tuned and we'll be right back with Mike. Michael Preisner, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Hi, Cindy. How are you?
Oh, it's good to finally have you on the show, and it's been great to see you a couple times recently. I think once in Tucson, Arizona, when we were at that conference, and then last week you organized a wonderful conference against police violence, and I just want to say one thing about that. We went straight from your conference in Los Angeles to one in Culver City about, I think it was called Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. And that event was mostly older white people. Your event was younger and more diverse. And it just like shows who is being harmed the most by this police state.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, one of the really amazing things about that conference was the all of the young youth from Santa Rosa who were leading really, I think, the most militant fight back against police brutality in the country, where, you know, a van load of kids as young as 7 years old, mostly about 11 or 12 years old, who were really at the front lines of this struggle for their friend, that 13-year-old Andy Lopez, who was killed by cop Eric Gelhouse. And so it was not only young people of you know, high school and college student age, but young people of, you know, 7 years old age who are really not only just participating in the struggle, but real leaders in the struggle.
And then there were some old white people like me.
There was. I'm getting there too, Cindy.
So it was really diverse. And, you know, it's just to me, I don't live that far from Santa Rosa. And I've been to the protests, and I've had a chance to talk with Andy's mom and dad. And, of course, that's heartbreaking. I know how it feels to have the empire, the police state, rob a child from you. But what a terrible, terrible thing that these young people have to confront. And but then it's a terrible thing they have to confront, but it's also very inspiring there. Their response to it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why it was very appropriate to have you speaking at that conference also, because, you know, these are the issues that we're wanting to connect, that the, you know, the forces that took Andy's son, or that took Andy, you know, from his parents, are the same that took your son from you, you know. And so it's inspiring to be able to see that it's all of us who have been fighting over the years, but also so many new layers of people who are being pushed into political struggle with us.
Also, you are an Army veteran, and I want you to talk about your experience along those lines. Why did you join? What has driven you to be, you know, an activist like you are now? But you gave one of the most, well, you gave the best talk or speech or whatever at the Winter Soldier event in Washington, D.C., and I just want to know, how did your speech get through? Because I know that, I know from people who went there that it was very, well, I know from before Winter Soldier how it was going to be, because I was banned from going. But I know that the speeches were very controlled, and somebody brought me back a list of don't words that one of the organizers gave out. Like, the don't words, two of them that I remember were Democrat and Empire. So how did your speech get through the management of Winter Soldier?
You know, I mean, there were, I think, some attempts to put guidelines in place and things like that. But I think what happened at Winter Soldier is, even though there was, you know, maybe some attempts at restrictions and trying to have a particular think about it, is, you know, when people really got up there, they they had their chance, you know, kind of the first time since the experience they had deployed to be able to express what they felt or share what they felt or apologize and all of these things. And so I think so much of Winter Soldier was not what was planned even by the people who went up there ahead of time, not even just by the organizers. And so, there was it was the same thing. You know, there was many things that I really felt I needed to say, and it was my first real opportunity to say them after really wrestling with them for so long and needing some kind of outlet like that. And so it was, I think what made it what it was just the need to really get those things out into the open.
And then as with the police, anti-police violence conference and all of our other struggles, you link the the class struggle and how it's people of color and people in the poor or working classes that have to suffer for these imperial crimes, and we suffer, and then there's a few that just profit extraordinarily during wars, mm-hmm. and empire and capitalism, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it was, and there's also there's a need to say these things that seems obvious to many of us, but, there's you can be anti-war with a bad anti-war perspective, an isolationist perspective of, we shouldn't be going into other countries because we should be just, who cares about freeing people abroad, that type, like the Ron Paul, right. libertarian type mode. And so, uh-huh. Being able to talk about class and talk about what our commonality is and where we all come from, that is something different. That's internationalism. And that's something much more profound, saying that it's, not only that we need to say that, we know who our enemies are, but the people who are responsible for hardship in our lives are responsible for hardship in people whose lives are very, very much like ours, who we're told to think are people totally separate from us, and want us to identify with our so-called leaders rather than, people on the other side of the world.
Well, also with the Ron Paul people, I hate to single that out, but, he's being identified with, that wing of the Republican Party. They think that some of them are like, and these wars aren't even constitutionally declared, as if mm-hmm. that would make them right.
Yeah, right, exactly. And that's what they're concerned about, is the illegal mechanisms, not the what it's doing to our brothers and sisters abroad. So
as if Congress had any kind of a special supernatural abilities to declare war, and then mm-hmm. and then they're okay, then we would support them or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So as long as it goes with the Constitution, Cindy. It's all about the Constitution.
Right. So, Michael, tell my listeners and myself about what led you to enlisting in the Army.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was one of those many, many people in this country who really bought into the really heavy indoctrination we have here of, military recruiters, when they go into schools, they have an easy job because every student in there has already grown up in the United States in a culture that is inundated with a culture of militarism, a culture of violence, a culture of glorifying war, a culture of patriotism and things like that. And so for me, growing up playing with G.I. Joe and watching war movies and, being pledging allegiance and all of this stuff, really feeling that the most selfless and noble and honorable thing you could do with your life was giving yourself to the U.S. military and being sent to help people in need and free the oppressed and defend your friends and family here at home. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what drew me. I mean, the sense of selflessness, the sense of wanting to be a part of some greater good, and believing that that greater good could be done inside the U.S. military.
Well, I know, for example, my son, you know, he joined, we live right next to Travis Air Force Base, you know, literally like, I don't know, maybe 5 miles from the front gate. And he was actively recruited in high school by the Air Force, and he really resisted. He had no interest in joining the U.S. military. And then he got out of high school and was in community college for 3 years and just working full time, going to school, seeing, what a struggle it was to do that. And, you know, on his way to, university, and just thinking that he really couldn't afford it and he really couldn't put any more financial burden on our family. So he was recruited at his community college at a so-called job fair. did you find any kind of economic, and motivation for joining the military?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't have good enough grades in high school to be able to get the state scholarships and stuff that were available. And so I knew that college was something that, wasn't, gonna be feasible. So, you know, the college scholarship, made a big difference, the things about job training, but also, you know, it was, the idea of a future, you know, like envisioning, you know, for so many young people today in this country, it's hard to envision a future. I mean, it's hard to, you know, college takes years and years now to graduate and puts you super deep in debt. Even if you have that college degree, it's almost, you know, impossible to find a decent job at a wage that's, you know, with dignity that you deserve. And so there's so much, you know, dismal prospects for youth today. And so not only do you have this thing that's saying that, you know, you can be a part of something good and you can, be this honorable hero, but it's stability. It's one way where you can see a future. You know, it's one way where you can see, you know, being able to have education guaranteed, a job training guaranteed, benefits guaranteed, a pension guaranteed, and all of these things. And so it's, of course, to me too, just like it is to everyone, these are things that you normally can't rely on, but the idea of being able to rely on these benefits are very appealing to people.
Well, also, when did you join the Army, Michael? And what year was that? And then, what, you know, give us some of your experience while you were in the military.
Sure. Well, I actually joined a couple months before the September 11th attacks. I joined. I actually enlisted for the Army between my junior and senior year of high school in 2000 when I was had just turned 17 and was in this delayed entry program that they have, which we can talk about later. It's a key part of their tricking kids into being recruited into the military. Right. But I actually left for basic training on my 18th birthday in June of 2001. I went to basic training in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and then I went to the military intelligence school in Fort Huachuca, Arizona for 6 months. And then I got to my duty station at Fort Drum in upstate New York in the 10th Mountain Division. And so, you know, up and through this time in the Army, you know, my first 2 years in the Army, really, I was still loving it. You know, it was my childhood dream to be a soldier. I thought I was going to be a career soldier. This is what I had always wanted. And so, I was very, very happy with a decision I had made, and I was very motivated to be in the Army, and I was, you know, wanting to go to every school I could go to and working hard to get promoted and all of these different things. And then the Iraq war began to get ramped up for the indications that we were going to be going to war. And then things really changed. I mean, the war in Afghanistan had been going on, but it was like, you know, at that time in our minds, like, no one was going to be going because it was small numbers of people who were going, it seemed. And then it was just only certain units. And so in our minds, like, a deployment to Afghanistan wasn't really a thing that we were thinking about. But then when the Iraq war was starting, I mean, there was such a fervor. I mean, you could feel the tension and, the, you know, all of this, you know, excitement too around it. And, you know, when the war was starting, for me, it was, you know, I joined to dedicate myself to to some greater good. And that's what genuinely I was feeling. And so when the Iraq War was starting, I was following it very closely, of course, because I was in the military and knew that it was possible that I would go. And I believe the kind of core rationales for the war. I mean, I believe this, this idea that Saddam Hussein was this evil dictator. The Iraqi people were horribly oppressed and desperate to be liberated by some outside force to come save them. Right. And that what the U.S. military was going to do is go and hand over to the Iraqi people the reins of society, and so they could build a participatory, democratic, fair, and just society, like just like we have here in the United States, as I thought at the time. And so that was the core rationale I believed, and also did believe that there were these giant weapons that could be fired at us, and that my mom and dad and brother and sister could be in danger by this menace across the world and things like that. And so, I believed the things that we were being told over and over again on the news. And, I wasn't seeing things like the mass anti-war demonstrations that were taking place at that time. Those were hidden from us, and they were, concealed and distorted in the media. And so I was really only getting one side of the argument. And so because of all that, I mean, I wasn't even supposed to be on that deployment. The very small numbers of people from Fort Drum were going at that time, but only one squad from my platoon was being sent, and it wasn't my squad. And I made a very reasoned case why I should be on that deployment rather than someone else. And I was put on that deployment even though I wasn't supposed to be. And so I went to the I was part of the invasion of Iraq in March 2003. I actually, I didn't get into the country until March 26th. The, some may remember there was, Turkey was, supposed to be an entrance point for, large numbers of tanks and armored vehicles. And then there was such mass protests in Turkey that at the last moment they canceled that agreement. And so I was one of those people who was held up, as part of the northern invasion. So March 26th, I was on the first plane that landed in the north of the country. A few other planes had parachuted people in ahead of us. And that's when I got to Iraq, 11 years ago now. This is the anniversary week now. And so that's when all of my illusions about why we were there, began to change. And so right away, this idea about, weapons of mass destruction. I mean, I was in the military intelligence company in that entire area of operations in the north of the country. So if finding WMDs was anybody's job, it would have been our job.
Right.
And hearing WMDs discussed by the commanding officers, in that command center there, the other intelligence officers, it was very obvious that they knew that was not part of what we were doing at all. I mean, talking about finding that, like, it was just like, it was not part of the mission whatsoever. And it was almost kind of laughed at if you brought up like, oh, I think this is where these WMDs could be. It would just be kind of laughed at. But what we did make sure to do is we knew where the oil fields on the maps were.
Right.
And that's actually the first places that we went, is the areas, the oil fields that needed to be secured, supposedly because they were targets for terrorist attacks or something. But then the rationale started to fall apart. But at that time, I think, understanding that the WMD's rationale was kind of falling apart and seeing that wasn't really, what we were there for, and also kind of not really trusting George W. Bush, because it really was hard to like that guy at any point. I really was holding on to this belief that we'd be giving a better life to the Iraqi people. And so I thought, well, even if this WMD thing is BS, even if there are these motives to get oil by Bush and some of his friends, we're still going to be getting rid of this dictator, and we're still going to be giving a new and better life to the Iraqi people. And so that's what I was trying to hold on to
right.
through that deployment. But it was through that deployment that that was the reality of that was revealed to me, that the experiences that changed my view were those where I was in a position where I was extremely morally conflicted about what I was doing, how the Iraqi people were seeing me, and doing things that were nothing close to what I thought it would be, which would be helping these people, giving them something better, and having a real, genuine relationship with them that was one that was not of an occupying force in a country where you're seen as something terrible, and rightfully so. And so it was experiences of that nature that made me feel really conflicted about what I was doing. And so I actually began to develop anti-war views while I was in Iraq. I wrote something publicly that was published from Iraq that was talking mainly, you know, not a very well-formed thing, but expressing the confusion and the betrayal and the feeling like I was going to do one thing and then something else had happened. So it was those, was the general trajectory. And I got home, really feeling angry and betrayed and, about what I had just been a part of, and really wanted to know why it had happened, you know, what it was all about. And so, I just really tried to study and read and find out everything I could about the war, about U.S. foreign policy. And I was still in the army at this time and still was considering staying in. And it was very easy to direct all your anger at the Bush administration and the Republican Party and the neocons and say it was all their fault. And so that was my initial thing. And I remember in 2004 when John Kerry was running, I was like, yes, this is not George W. Bush. Right. But then even then I was like, well, wait, I don't think he's talking about ending the war either. And then that kind of showed to me the kind of the nature of the Republican and Democratic parties where there's really not much difference at all. And so I couldn't just direct my anger at the Republican Party. I had to direct my anger at both. And so it was through continuing to try to dig and discover what it really was, I started to learn about imperialism and how that drive to war and that expansion is something that wasn't a decision by a particular president who had some friends in some oil companies, but something that's more fundamental to the nature of the system itself. And so that's where I developed a more a class view of things rather than just a view that there's some politicians who are bad and there's some who are good, but that there's a system ultimately that's responsible. And so we got out of the army in 2005 and felt very still very angry, still very betrayed, and also very alone and very powerless. Right. I had just been through this experience. And I was very mad about it, but I had nothing to do with all of those feelings. And I had, you know, I had been in the military to begin with, too, because I had this drive to do something positive in the world. And then I had my world turned upside down by being made to do what I saw as the opposite. And so I had all of this frustration and felt completely, completely powerless with it. And the first time that changed is when, you know, I had met people who were anti-war on my college campus, and I had started helping organize small anti-war vigils in South Florida, things like that. But in 2006, I believe, 2007, we mobilized a car caravan to ANSWER demonstration in Washington, D.C., a march on the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. I think maybe you were there. It was one of the freezing yeah. cold days. And so me and a couple of my friends organized a caravan of cars from South Florida to go to D.C. for this demonstration. And that was the first time I felt like I had power, that I felt like all of these things that all of us had been through could actually be formed into something that was, could be a weapon that could fight back. And so, you know, with standing there with thousands and thousands of people, many other Iraq War veterans, many other, you know, people who are my age, young people, but people who had protested against the Vietnam War. I mean, having thousands of people and right outside the Pentagon, I mean, right outside the belly of the beast, you know, with such energy and such momentum, I knew that that was the way that we were going to be able to solve these issues. You know, that was the way we were going to be able to stop the Iraq War, but stop the system that was sending us to those wars. And so that day I decided I didn't just want to be someone who was marching in the demonstrations. I wanted to be doing whatever I could to build mass actions against the war. And I guess that's ever since I've been trying my best to do that.
Well, Michael, thank you so much. There's been a couple of reports recently, and like you said, this is right around the time that you were deployed 11 years ago. Let me do my math. And my son then was deployed 10 years ago, and in just like 5 days will be the 10th anniversary from when Casey was killed. But recently there were two reports from, you know, the empire. And, you know, by the way, I was in Venezuela in 2006 at the World Social Forum. And that's where I first got to know President Hugo Chavez. And, of course, people in South America, many people around the world, they look at the U.S. as the empire. But I was told by many U.S. anti-war activists at the World Social Forum that I shouldn't say empire. It's such that word is so passe and blah, blah, blah. Because then I found out, of course, very soon that they're not necessarily anti-war. They're just anti-Republican war. And so anyway, that's just my little comment. But recently, I think just this past week, first of all, Admiral Dennis Blair said that he was testifying to the committee on the House Committee on Foreign Affairs about the geopolitical potential of the U.S. energy boom. And of course, they tout fracking and offshore drilling as things that will get us off foreign oil, not saying that we should get off all you know, fossil fuels. But he said that we sent troops to the Middle East because of oil-based importance of the region. And, you know, to me, it's like, who can I sue for wrongful death of my son? You know, can I sue the oil companies? Can I sue the empire? But because, you know, and you just said, you guys, and we know that the troops in the initial invasion went straight to guard the oil fields because they didn't want Saddam to do what he did in the first Gulf War, and that's to set the oil fields on fire, God forbid. And then recently, I think Barack Obama was at the G7. It used to be the G8, but they kicked Russia out. And he said that, and this is like this is just like blows my mind. I'm never surprised what the empire says or does, but the hypocrisy and the obvious falseness of what Obama said, and I don't think he's telling this to the rest of the world, because the rest of the world knows he's full of crap. He's telling this to the U.S. He's telling this to the gullible people who, like you said, we've been under the thumb of capitalism and empire our entire lives and propaganda. He said that what Russia's doing in the Crimea is far worse than what the U.S. did in Iraq. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I mean, it's a kind of a mind-blowing statement. It's hard to even really know where to begin with it. But this is part of the attempt to of the U.S. government to write the history of the Iraq War. And so actually this statement that Obama made Before I comment on that, this is, on the 10th anniversary of the war in Iraq. When the war was finally over, President Obama made his first kind of, real public statement as the president about what his view of the Iraq war was. And that's when he made, the anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, a national holiday, that the National Day of Honor. And so that now is on the U.S. calendar as the day that the United States invaded, this, illegal war of aggression on a sovereign nation, what was defined at the Nuremberg trials as the greatest crime against humanity. That's now a national day of honor. And so that was the beginning of what was to be a rewrite by Washington of the Iraq war. And so this statement by Obama is part of that, attempt to say, this is what happened. This is the legacy of the Iraq war. And so it should get rid of all allusion to people who supported Obama as an anti-war candidate. In particular, while he was still saying, I like the war in Afghanistan, we want to make that bigger. So many people were holding on to the fact that he opposed the Iraq war. And we know now what his feelings about it were. Maybe at the time, as a matter of policy, he was opposed to the Iraq war, but he's doing what presidents do, which is be the manager for the imperialists, for the generals in the Pentagon. And so, of course, he has to fall in line with them and their version of history. But to say that, to even try to draw any kind of comparison with a situation with Russia in Crimea, Crimea which had been part of Russia for all of history up until just a few decades ago.
Right.
And of course, that the situation there being a completely defensive thing, real legitimate cases for defending the local population there against, right-wing militias and things like that. And looking at the pictures. To call something a hostile invasion and occupation, we can see what's happening on the ground there. We can see what it looks like with soldiers around certain areas and how the people view them and things like that. Trying to compare that to an occupation that every single person in the country was so angered and enraged by that, millions of people in the country rose up in anger and to fight and drive out the U.S. military that was carrying out so many atrocities on a daily basis. So much death, so much destruction, torture. The long list of war crimes and things that were done to the Iraqi people is really, it's really impossible to overstate what was done to them. And so it was, it's not going to be the last thing like that we see from the Obama administration, but this is what they do. When they carry out great crimes and when they do things that are so obviously wrong, they're the ones that have the ability to write the history. And just like that, that other person you mentioned who, was kind of openly admitting that the war was about, resource interests in the region, it's no longer any secret, really.
Right.
And that all of the rationales, the things I talked about earlier about weapons of mass destruction and all of the things that we were told by the politicians going into the war, we know now that, those were all lies and that, not only were they lies, but when George Bush and Rumsfeld and Colin Powell, when they were saying them, they knew that they were lies. They knew that what they were saying about WMDs was not true. And that's been exposed. And so the real motives for the war, are now exposed as fact. And there's no longer any debate over it, really. But regardless of what's known as fact, we're still going to see politicians stand up there and say, this was a great war. We did great things for people, and it was such an honorable thing.
Well, and not just what we did, but the legacy is going to be continuing forever. Look at in Vietnam, people are still suffering from the effects of Agent Orange, and in Iraq, it's depleted uranium, especially in Fallujah and Basra, where you know, there's horrible birth defects and children who are suffering from heart tumors and blood cancers. And, you know, that's not going to stop. That's going to continue.
That's right. You know, Fallujah, I mean, a way to illustrate the crisis in Fallujah, I mean, doctors have told women in Fallujah not to have babies.
Right.
I mean, just think about that. I mean, the amount of, you know, just the level of, you know, horrific, legacy that has now been put on the people there, to where it's a city that can't live, that can't reproduce itself, that can't have a generation of children, right? I mean, it's just kind of the most, disgusting thing that can be done to a people and to a population, is to poison their ability to recreate themselves and their families. And so it's, you know, just one of the many, many examples of how Iraq for a very, very long time, is going to be suffering from what the U.S. government did to them.
Oh, so sad. I met a doctor from Basra when I was in Japan a few years ago, right after the earthquake and tsunami. And he was there because, of course, you know, his patients are suffering from the effects of radiation poisoning. So he's from Basra, and he was telling me about, you know, not only are these incidents escalating dramatically and tragically, but they don't have the medicine or the equipment to fight it because mm-hmm. of what the U.S. did. So, you know, it just makes me so sad to think mm-hmm. of what we've done around the world to people. We're never ending cancer on the planet, I think. And that's why it's so important for us to keep fighting here. Mm-hmm. Like you said, the belly of the beast. I like to call it the bowels of the beast.
More appropriate.
You know, let's talk about what my listeners can do. You have outlined a powerful case against joining the military. Mm-hmm. And recently the military put out a paper on, it was called like Civilian Obstacles to Recruitment or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I was very proud to be named on page 12. And mm-hmm. so to me, that was a huge victory. If I've stopped one person from joining the military, to me, that's wonderful. But I know there's been many, many people because of our efforts in the truth in recruitment or counter recruitment, you know, movement that have made a big difference. So how can my listeners become involved in helping us stop our young people from being used as, you know, basically hired killers, well, and dispensable, you know, the military and the empire couldn't care less about our troops, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, there's a great amount of resources and things that people can use if they know young people or students or anyone who's thinking about joining the military. There's a really good wealth of information, kind of recruitment materials and things like that. But when you're talking about high school students or people who are recent graduates, especially young people in high school, though, and also people in middle school, because military recruiters also target people who are younger than high school age. It's part of their way of implanting that in them, and so they're easier to get to when they're in high school. But we're talking about high school age students. They're not really trying to just be handed a pamphlet of counter-recruitment materials and then read them and say, okay, I'm going to make this logical, informed decision to not join the military. The thing that is most effective with young people who are targeted by recruiters is that actual interaction with people who have been in the military or military families who have experience with what military life is like. Me and many other vets I work with, and ANSWER and March Forward, and IVAW, we've done a lot of counter-recruitment in actual high schools, talking to kids, but also being contacted to do one-on-one meetings with people. People who are listening, I mean, if you're getting into high schools, is such a beneficial thing to those kids. You know, every single, you know, I speak in a lot of high schools here in the Los Angeles area, you know, places in the, where that are very, very heavily targeted by military recruiters, especially in South Los Angeles, you know, places like Roosevelt High School and things like that. And I'll go into a classroom full of kids and at the beginning ask for a show of hands of who's considering joining the military. And usually it's about 75% of the class. It's a high number of people who, when asked that question, are you thinking about joining, will say, yes, that's how many people are think about it in their minds. But to be able to spend, just a half hour with those kids and just go through the very basic things that they're told by their recruiters or the very basic reasons they have for wanting to join, and then telling them the reality of it from a firsthand perspective, by the end of those classes, there's not a single kid in the class raising their hand when I ask that same question at the end of the class.
Wow. Awesome.
And so people who have, these kids are smart. They get it. They just need someone to be able to be able to explain it. So anyone who has any ability to get access into high school classrooms, I know there's many organizations who do this, but also people who have connections with different teachers and things like that. Getting vets, anti-war vets, into classrooms is something that, we always can use help with because it's a hard thing to do. But also, if you know individual people and want someone like me to be able to call them to talk about joining or meet with them in person, myself and so many others are always willing to do that kind of stuff. And so whatever people can do to put young people thinking of joining in touch with people like us really, really makes all the difference.
Well, Michael Preisner, how can my listeners get a hold of you, and what would be the best link that you could send them to for information about counter recruitment?
Sure. Well, you may know that in 2009, myself and several other Iraq War veterans and active duty soldiers started a group called March Forward, an anti-imperialist veterans and service members organization. And so you can go to marchforward.org. You can actually, there's some articles about some of the counter-recruitment work that we've done in the past and some resources there. But through that website, that's how you can get in touch with me and our organization and our other branches around the country. So wherever you are, if there's a way you think you can link us up with someone then you can get in touch with us through there. And that's where you can find out all the other types of work we're doing too.
Well, Michael Preisner, is there anything else you want my listeners to know?
Everyone should be voting for you in this gubernatorial election. So they should know. I'm looking forward to being able to spread the word about that with you as well.
Yeah, everybody in California. So, Michael Preisner, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. It was really great to talk to you.
Thank you, Cindy.
And
keep up the good work.
Thanks for what you do. It's very
you
important.
You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
That's Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox for today. I really hope you go to marchforward.org and take advantage of their resources and help us help young people to make wiser choices, to not be inserted into the meat grinder of this empire and perpetual war. War for profit, war for power, no noble cause. And this week will mark the 10th anniversary of my son's death, and we will be commemorating it as usual, trying to make the world a better place. As always, I'd like to thank Don DeBard, our engineer, and our connection with CPR Metro. I'd like to thank Michael Preisner for being our guest this week, Dee Dee Miller for being the, gopher assistant for Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, Mikey for being our occasional co-producer or associate producer. And as always, I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.